Okay, does anyone have any questions before we start?
No.
All right. If there's anyone here who didn't pick up their exams last time, I brought them in again, and you can pick them up after class. And those of you who asked me to take a look at your exams and possible change the grade, I've done that, and the exams with the new grades are also available after class, okay? All righty. Where are we at this point in the class? Don't forget, we have this general problem. It's a conceptual problem of how do you explain international conflict? And we're trying to get at that problem by looking at the great conflicts of the 20th century. Second half of the class is devoted to the Cold War, which dominated international politics for nearly half a century after the end of World War II. And the Cold War is of interest for two reasons, because we can focus on this whole question of, what was the Cold War about as a way of getting insight into that larger question, what causes conflict? And also, since a stable peace eventually took shape during the Cold War period, we're also interested in studying this for the insight it gives us into the question of how it is possible for a stable international order to take shape. And how do we how have we gone about doing that? We've focused on what's puzzling. What's puzzling about the Cold War? See? Here's Europe, essentially the world as a whole, or at least the most important parts of the world from the standpoint of war-making potential. Europe to a certain extent, East Asia. Divided between East and West. Soviets control Eastern Europe, United States and America's friends control Western Europe. For both sides, that situation, that status quo of a divided Europe, divided Germany, is vastly preferable to a Third World War. Maybe they would ideally like to control all of Europe, all of the world, see their system spread, become universal. But, whatever aspirations of that sort either side has, they're disciplined by power political realities. They don't think it's worth a Third World War. The Americans don't think it's worth a Third World War to see democratic regimes emerge in Eastern Europe. Soviets are not going to go to war with the United States in order to communize Western Europe, by and large, right? And what this means is that you have a kind of a rule, an implicit rule, about how the two sides can get along with each other. They control their side of the line of demarcation in Europe. We control our side of the line of demarcation of Europe. On that basis, the two sides should get along with each other. Go their separate ways. No need for a war. No need for, severe conflict. It's like... But we know, as an empirical fact, that didn't happen. Well, that's a puzzle. How do you explain that puzzle? Right? Was it because both sides are so ideological that these power political realities didn't mean much to them? No, we saw at Potsdam how Stalin and Burns had reached an understanding, tacit, implicit, largely. And we saw how that understanding, which had focused at Potsdam on Germany, the Burns Plan being the heart of that understanding, was rounded out by other agreements having to do with Eastern Europe, with Greece, with Japan, by the end of 1945. Just looking at the evidence from that period, you'd say, well, that should have been the end of it. Doesn't matter how ideological they are, they were forced by these political realities to make this sort of reach this sort of understanding, and on that basis, the two sides could get along. Perfectly stable system, you might say. Soviet power and American power balanced each other in Europe so completely that neither of those great states, nor let alone any third power like Germany, had any room for maneuver to bring about dramatic changes in the status quo. Very different from 1919, right? It's like, well, but it doesn't work. Why doesn't it work? Well, we focused first on 1945. Why did the Cold War break out in 1946? Why the Americans are banging the drums about how the Soviets are untrustworthy, they don't keep their promises about Germany and so on. Those claims, you know, were false. But they were made for instrumental purposes. We had to mobilize the energies of our own people. Why did we have to do that? Because this whole notion of a friendly division of Europe wasn't going to work. They came to that conclusion because of what the Soviets were doing in the Near East, that to say Turkey and Iran, in early 1946. It seemed that the only thing these people respected was force. Therefore, in order to kind of keep them at bay, you had to generate countervailing power. You can only do that by mobilizing the energies of your own people, and also you needed to worry about the Germans and bringing the Germans over to your side, because the strategy that you were adopting contemplated the division of Germany, which is hard, people thought, for a nationalistic country like Germany to accept. And so we went that route, but it runs its course. The whole Western strategy results in the creation of a West German state. The Soviets create their own state in East Germany. We create our formal security system, North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. They eventually respond by creating a treaty system of their own. They in effect, seem to be accepting the status quo by ending the Berlin blockade. All these great events, NATO, creation of the Federal Republic of Germany, the end of the Berlin blockade, spring of 1949. All right? Saying, oh, well, second great chance for peace. But again, we know it doesn't work, because 50-51, the world moves into this really deep crisis. As I say, to my mind, it's the deepest crisis of the whole post-1945. What had happened? The Soviets had never accepted what the West was doing in West Germany. They put their objections on hold for the time being because they didn't have enough military power to challenge the status quo. Very different after they broke the American nuclear monopoly, you know, and for the reasons that I discussed. Military reasons. Having to do with the way military power worked in the early atomic age. The USSR felt, well, it may have to bring matters to a head. All the more so because the United States was building up, had decided in the end of 1950 to build up its power, and if possible, the power of its European allies and even of West Germany. And if the balance was going to be turning against the Soviets and war with America was inevitable because of what the Americans were doing in Germany, then better have it out with them now rather than later. So you have this sharpening of Soviet policy, expected, predicted. And when it came in Korea, not just the North Korean invasion of the South in June, but the Chinese intervention in the war in October and November, which is much more serious, people interpreted Soviet policy in the context of that general, you know, framework, that general set of ideas. They are much more aggressive now because they have this window of opportunity. They use that term, but that's what people meant. They were strong now as America built up its power and come slowly, you know. They wouldn't have a chance to challenge what the Americans were doing if the Americans were intent on building up a strong West German state and underwriting a revisionist policy that state would pursue, if only in order to keep West Germany in the Western camp. Then that's a fundamental threat to the most basic security interests of the Soviet state. A sharp conflict is inevitable. Let's have it out with the West now when we still have a chance of winning. And, you know, Stalin actually says this to Mao when he's encouraging the Chinese to intervene in the Korean War. You know, if war is inevitable, let it happen now. Okay? So the second chance for peace fails. And then what happens? We come very close to a Third World War in the winter of 50-51. What could have tipped the balance the other way is if the Americans had gotten their way, I should say if Secretary of State Dean Acheson had gotten his way and gotten the Europeans to go along with the rearmament of Germany, because it really does seem that the Soviets were poised on the brink as it was, and this would have tipped the balance and led the Soviets to say, we got to deal with this matter, nip it in the bud, take care of it before it gets totally out of hand. Okay? We cannot stand a strong, powerful, militarized German state, West German state. Right? The Europeans, including the Germans themselves, are able to throw sand into the gears. You know, just stop as you sit down. One of the tactics they used was to come up with this plan for a European defense community, famous EDC it was called. Everything gets slowed down because this whole set of problems of how much sovereignty is Germany going to have, as opposed to the occupying powers, the three Western allies. Is Germany going to be fully sovereign? Is Germany going to have control over her own destiny? What sort of limits are there going to be on German military powers? What's Germany's relationship with the West going to be? Is Germany going to have an army that's capable of standing up to the Soviets on its own? And is Germany going to be able to create enough military power that she could, wouldn't be dependent on the Western allies, but could protect herself and indeed perhaps pursue a revisionist policy vis-a-vis East Germany? Right? All those issues, very difficult issues, because people don't trust the Germans, but you can't quite say, we don't trust you, that's why we want to put limits on your power. Because you have to say, we want to take you in as partners, but, right? And the question is, what is that but going to be? Are you going to not have a German national army, but simply German contingents and some sort of European army or Atlantic army? Very difficult issues, in each in its own right. And then when you realize that it's a whole big ball of wax and all these things are interconnected, this is going to take a very long time to negotiate. But they reach a first set of agreements in 1952. Those agreements then have to be ratified by the various national parliaments. And the French, who come up with this plan for the EDC in December of 1950, kind of as a way of slowing the Americans down, the French now are very reluctant to go along with it. Because any of these plans, it has to be equality between France and Germany, right? If you say there can't be a German national army, that means there can't be a French national army either. It's like France is supposed to relinquish her sovereignty. This is very hard for a great nation, ancient nation, to accept. Very reluctant to go along with this. Finally, the whole thing is voted down in August of 1954. And by this time, America had really built up its power. Overwhelming power. It's like Soviets had this massive force that they had built up, but it's armed with armaments that are obsolescent, if not totally obsolete, because of what the Americans had created. The nuclear area, all these areas having to do with electronics, and computers, in a serious way for the first time. Soviets can't match any of this stuff. Not just that, but there were breakthroughs in the whole area of targeting intelligence, both what you can learn from just listening in and also from overflights. The calculation was that if war broke out in 1954, Soviet Union would be utterly destroyed, and the Americans would come off of this scot-free, maybe even Western Europe, scot-free. If we struck fast enough and hard enough, right? This was the heyday of American nuclear superiority, strategic superiority. This period from late 52, through 55, 56, something like that. Essentially the early Eisenhower period, the first Eisenhower administration. This is America would never be that strong again. Overwhelming nuclear superiority. And incidentally, it changed the Soviet behavior. Soviets had been very bellicose in 1950, the Korean War being the best example of this, but that's not all there was. There was all these indications that they were, you know, getting ready for a Third World War, preparing for it militarily in terms of propaganda and so on. Now, by 1952, and this is before the death of Stalin in 1953, can't you attribute it to a change in personnel? In 1952, I say, purring like pussycats, as sweet as can be, you know, just, they don't want to come close to provoking the Americans. A very militant mood, very anti-communist mood at this point. You know, this is the period of McCarthyism in the United States. Right? So the Americans are so strong that the West is able to work out its own political system without having to worry about any Soviet threat. Right? They had a totally free hand. And they come up with the system of the Paris Accords, October of 1954. So very soon after the French had defeated EDC in August. You see, the system of the Paris Accords, and I explained to you last time what the Paris Accords called for. These, you know, Germany was being made into a kind of partner, not quite a full partner. You know, Germany was given a lot of sovereignty, but not full sovereignty. There were these things called the reserved powers and the reserved rights, where the three Western occupying powers in Western Germany. You know, they reserved certain powers to themselves, which the Germans accepted. And basically, it was like the Germans couldn't kick these Western forces out of their territory. These Western forces had the right to conduct military operations from bases on German territory without first getting the okay of the German government. You know, the Germans didn't have a right to negotiate by themselves with the Soviets for matters relating to Berlin or to, you know, the reunification of Germany. They couldn't negotiate some sort of deal that would provide for reunification, but with Germany leaving the Western Bloc, and even the Western powers could intervene in extreme circumstances if the democratic order in Western Germany was threatened by communists, by the neo-Nazi movement, whatever. You know, these are very substantial limitations on Germany's freedom of action, which persisted right through to the unification of Germany in 1991, end of the Cold War in 1991, and even in the post-Cold War period. The Treaty of Moscow, the treaty that provided for the reunification of Germany, still imposed important limits on German sovereignty, the most important being that Germany could not become a nuclear power. And if you are not a nuclear power yourself, there's no way you could stand up to another nuclear power if there's a political conflict. And that forces you into dependence on your protectors. And if your protectors don't really care about, you know, supporting your more extreme goals, you don't have any choice but to kind of trim your sails and accept that. All right? The system of the Paris Accords, you know, transformed Germany's political status, Germany's military status. Yes, Germany was going to have an army, a national army, not just kind of contingents in a European or Atlantic army, but an army under its own control. But that army couldn't be used independently because the whole logistical system that supported it was based, for very sound military reasons, on the rear areas, you know, away from the battlefield, in France, in Holland, in Belgium, you know. And where that German army was deployed would be determined by the NATO commander, who's an American general, Sackier. And the NATO commander would be thinking in functional military terms, not political terms, you know. That this whole system of an expanded powers for the NATO authorities, for Sackier, as he was called, the Supreme Allied Commander in Europe, the NATO commander, American general. Number one, it tended to limit Germany's freedom of action because Germany couldn't use her military force independently. But also, it integrated Germany into this Western system based on a strong Sackier, a strong American military presence. German power would be contained in the structure dominated by the United States, but also this American-dominated system would provide security for Germany against any possible Soviet threat. Right? So it was like a kind of two-edged sword, this whole system. And so what you have with the coming into effect of the Paris Accords. One other point about the Paris Accords that I should stress. The Paris Accords provided for an American-dominated system, right? Strong American presence. You know, these Europeans, the Germans, they weren't going to allow it to go nuclear. So if they were to be protected against a nuclear power like the Soviet Union, it would have to be by a power like the United States. You know, American power would serve as a counterweight to Soviet power in Europe. And people look at this and they say, oh, here are the Americans out to create an empire for themselves. There you go, Imperial America. America's so strong. She's determined to kind of throw her weight around and impose her rule on Western Europe. These are very popular ideas in Western Europe, especially in France, to a certain extent in Germany. At the time, they still have a certain resonance today. You know, all this, you know, I have to say, it is total nonsense. It is exactly the reverse of the truth. These political notions come into being because they serve political purposes, not because they represent historical truth. It's not the Americans who wanted to impose their control in Europe. We were there, but very reluctantly. Eisenhower, he didn't like this stuff at all. He accepted Paris Accords very grudgingly. You know, you look at these documents and they feel like we have no choice. It's basically the British and the French who take the lead in fashioning this arrangement. An arrangement whose central elements, whose linchpin, is this American military presence in Europe. It's the Europeans who want us in. We don't want to go in if we could help it. We don't want to make these big promises. We don't want to have to carry the big burden of the defense of Europe. Let these people do it themselves. And I'll talk about this more. That's the basic Eisenhower philosophy, all right? But for our purposes, reluctantly, grudgingly, whatever, the agreements are signed. And in principle, you might think that they would provide a basis for a stable international order in Europe, or stable order of great power politics. They don't. Paris Accords signed in October 54, ratified the next year. First German soldier puts on his uniform in 1955. You know, it's like 3 years later, November 58, you have this second great period of crisis beginning. November 58, why is that date important? Because that's when Khrushchev, the Soviet leader, Nikita Khrushchev, lays down his famous Berlin ultimatum, right? Berlin, land island in the middle of communist East Germany, very easy for them to exercise pressure on us by threatening access to Berlin. Do that in 50. Oops. Okay. Oh, okay. Why did the 1954 arrangements not work? That question then has to be the focus of our analysis. See, was it because the Soviets would not go along with this? No. Why would the Soviets go along with this arrangement? Because it solved their number one security problem in Europe, in fact, in the world as a whole. Namely, the control of German power. Even West Germany, which is, you know, by far the most important part of Germany, you know, economically, technologically, and so on. East Germany is much more agricultural. Even West Germany, unconstrained, was capable of developing enough military power to support a revisionist foreign policy. To raise the risk of a new world war, and to really pose a serious threat to the USSR's most fundamental political interests in Europe. Here's the USSR, scarred by the experience of the Second World War. You know, 27 million Soviet citizens had been had died in the war. I mean, this is, you know, just an enormous degree of devastation. To this day, it's like seared its way into the Russian national consciousness. Here, the Americans, why should the Americans care about the unification of Germany? The Americans have fought the Germans twice. You know, the other Europeans, the British and the French, no interest in the unification of Germany. As long as Germany is weak, locked into dependence on the three great Western powers, well, Germany's not a threat, right? And therefore, the Soviets can go along with the system of the Paris Accords. What about the Germans themselves? Well, this is much harsher than Versailles. You don't have anything like this in the Versailles, Germany was a sovereign power. Yeah, there were limitations on Germany's armament, but the forces arrayed against Germany were much slighter than the forces keeping Germany down from 1954 on. Germany wasn't dependent on the Western powers after 1919, not therefore locked into, you know, following the policy that they pursued. Germany was not worried about the Soviet threat, and it was the Soviet threat after, you know, in the 50s that basically forced Germany into dependence on the West. You didn't have, you know, in the 50s you had a Soviet army in the middle of German territory, what had been pre-war German territory. You know, after 1919, Soviets were weak. They were pushed back behind this wall of hostile East European states tied to the West. You know, Germany is relatively free of Soviet pressure in that period. This, you know, but the Germans could accept the 1954 arrangements in a way that they could never accept the much milder arrangements that were imposed on them in 1919. Right? Why could they accept it again? Because it provided for their security. The Americans would protect them. Americans would serve as a counterweight to the Soviets and keep the Soviets back. That's the core thing. There are a variety of other reasons why the Germans would want to accept these arrangements. And I kind of referred to them a little bit last time. It's a form of moral rehabilitation. You know, given the crimes the Germans had committed during the Second World War, you know, people looked at them, you know, it's like, well, these are not quite civilized people. And now they're being taken back into the West. A little warily, it's true, not quite as full partners, but they're still being integrated in the Western world, made part of Western civilization, accepted back into it, especially part of Western Europe. So all this talk in those days about building Europe, transcending the nation state, you know, creating a kind of United States of Europe, a federal Europe, you know. It's like all these things going on in the economic sphere, the European Economic Community, and so on. These endeavors had a political goal, which is to create ultimately a kind of freestanding Europe, which would allow the Germans to kind of look at themselves in the mirror and think of themselves as Europeans and not just these nasty nationalistic Germans. So all this stuff meant that the Germans also could accept this if the system worked as advertised, right? If the Americans agreed to provide security for them. Right? But there was a third major power that had to go along with this for the system to work. And that power was, of course, the United States of America. And the big problem with the 1954 system was that even though we signed the Paris Accords and ratified the treaties and so on, the last thing Eisenhower wanted was to accept that sort of system as a permanent basis for U.S.-European relations. This is very important. This is the key element in explaining why you get a new crisis, you know, in 1958. It's a combined crisis, the Berlin-Cuban crisis from November of 58 to October of 1962, central episode of the whole Cold War. It's like, how do you explain that? A lot of times you read the literature on this stuff, it's just these crises, they just kind of happen, you know, out of the blue. No. They can only be understood when we understand this larger story. Because the Americans didn't want to go along with us. What did we want under Eisenhower? Eisenhower dominates American policy in this period, beginning in January 1953. He has a very clear concept for what he wants. You know, it's like people think of Eisenhower as this kind of doddering old retired general who all he does is goes out and play golf. This was the kind of myth of those days. You know, he wasn't articulate the way a professor is. You know, and so all the professors would kind of dump on him and sneer at him. And I mean, you go back and reread the literature in the light of what we now know from the documents, and it's like. It's a joke at how the degree to which these people are misunderstood. All right. What's Eisenhower's dream? He wants a freestanding Europe. He wants the Americans to pull out of Europe. He wants the Europeans, meaning the continental West Europeans, West Germany, France, and then along flanked by Italy, Belgium, Holland and Luxembourg, right? Those six countries. He wants them to kind of come together in a federal unit, kind of a United States of Europe. And by coming together, they could generate enough power that would keep the Soviets at bay, and also you wouldn't have to worry about rearming Germany, because whatever Germany did would be as part of Europe, and so you didn't have to worry about German power. So it solved the German problem as well. United States of Europe, let the Europeans come together, build up their power, and they could balance the Soviets on their own, and the Americans then could, in Eisenhower's phrase, we could pull back and relax somewhat. We could reduce the level of our involvement in Europe down to something nominal, maybe like a single division. A division is like 10,000 men. It's not, you know, it's a serious military force, but it's not, you know, overwhelming. Leave Europe entirely and let the Europeans call the shots. Right? They're able to do this, and they should be asked to do this, because we do not want this kind of weak, neutered Western Europe that just relies on America for protection, that's just a ward of the United States. Because the resources of Europe, if they're going to matter politically, the Europeans themselves have to make an effort. They have to create forces that they can control, because that's the only way in which they're going to take these political issues seriously. And I should say this is an important thing for Eisenhower, because part of the problem, as he sees it, is that the Europeans don't take these issues seriously, because they're essentially powerless, totally dependent on America for their security. Then they can behave irresponsibly. And they complain, oh, the Americans they're going to abandon us in the end, because they'll never go to war with the Soviet Union for fear of what the Soviets could do to the United States as well. They'll say that. You know, the Americans are too weak. And then in the same breath, they'll say, oh, the Americans are too bellicose. If the Soviets get out of line, the Americans really will escalate and use nuclear weapons. And then Europe is going to be devastated. You know, so we don't want that. So we don't want either thing. And you find the same people saying the same thing, sometimes in the same breath. And for Eisenhower, this is just, these people are irresponsible. Why are they irresponsible? Because they don't have political control. They don't have the forces which would enable them to pursue an independent policy. We don't want Europe to be just a bunch of American satellites. We want a freestanding, independent Europe under Eisenhower. Okay? The implication of this? How could this freestanding Europe stand up to the Soviet Union if it doesn't have nuclear weapons? It can't. Soviet Union is a nuclear power. If the Europeans don't have nuclear weapons, there's no way they could stand up to the Soviets. There's no way they could have their own independent policy. Right? Freestanding Europe implies a Europe armed with nuclear weapons. Not just little things for the theater, but things that are capable of attacking the Soviet homeland. Right? Because otherwise, the Soviet Union wouldn't be deterred. So the implication of the, first, the Eisenhower concept is important because it implies the nuclear armament of Europe, ideally on a unified basis. But the problem is that the Europeans, to Eisenhower's frustration, are unwilling to just kind of come together and call a constitutional convention and unify themselves overnight. They have these kind of, what Eisenhower views as these antiquated nationalistic prejudices. They still want to hold on to their national identities, very irritating from the American point of view. And so the Americans say, well, if the best we can get is a gradual process, that's better than nothing. And they have in mind this kind of gradual process. The Europeans would unify by emphasizing these kind of common economic structures, the common market, the coal and steel community, and all these things that the great champions of the European idea, people like Jean Monnet, you know, had their hearts set on. Americans say, well, if that's the way they want to do it, they want to focus on that first. That'll eventually lead to a true political unification because you'll need politically responsible organs to control these economic structures, right? So, and then in the military sphere, also they take this kind of gradualist approach and say, well, you know, we Americans can't contemplate an immediate withdrawal in Europe. The Europeans need this American umbrella while they're going through this whole lengthy process of kind of coming together. And what we want to do is first help them provide for their local defense, defense in the theater, including with the tactical nuclear weapons, which are, I'll explain to you why they're needed in a minute. And then only eventually will they get the big stuff, the strategic nuclear weapons capable of hitting targets in the Soviet homeland, right? But it's, you know, it's a gradual movement in that direction. And hopefully, as the Europeans, you know, proceed to build up their military power slowly, they'll try and do it on a transnational basis where they're cooperating with each other. Especially the three, you know, the continental countries, France and Germany, maybe with Italy as well, cooperating with each other. All right, so that's the dream of Eisenhower. It implies an independent European strategic capability. And if they're not going to be able to do it on a federal basis immediately, and the most you could hope for is that they'll be able to develop these defense structures on a national basis, but with these national armies kind of coordinated with each other in terms of strategy, that's great. The old NATO system, this could devolve into a European system. The NATO commander, American general, he could become a European. In fact, Eisenhower talks a lot about him being a French general. That's the goal. In the meantime, if all you can hope for is our strong national defenses kind of knitted together in some sort of international framework of that sort, that's great, that's fine, we will support that. And people in the American government say, well, we can understand you saying that the British should have a nuclear force, even the French should have a nuclear force. But the Germans? You really trust the Germans? You really want the Germans to have their finger on the nuclear trigger? And Eisenhower answers that very directly in a way that shows that he's free of any national prejudice. You know, and it's like a pure realist approach. And Eisenhower's answer is, well, Germany was a problem in the past because Russia was weak. Now that Russia is strong, I will take a strong Germany. He's actually in favor of helping the Germans acquire a nuclear capability under their own control, right? Very important, because of what it tells us about the viability of the 1954 system, right? That's one of the great taproots, the three great taproots of what was called at the time the nuclear sharing policy. Nuclear sharing was this American policy under Eisenhower. It meant we should help the Europeans, European allies, acquire control of nuclear weapons, independent control of nuclear weapons. perhaps of American nuclear weapons, because we have the technology, we're churning these things out like sausages during this period. And maybe even develop their own independent nuclear infrastructure so they could build these things themselves. Okay. This nuclear sharing policy, German finger on the trigger, you see how the Soviets would react to this sort of thing. It means that the Paris Accord system, you know, this is not going to work, because the key element in the Paris Accords was Germany was not going to be a nuclear power and the Americans were going to be in. Eisenhower was saying the Americans are going to go out, and the other side of that coin is that the Europeans, and in particular the Germans, should have nuclear forces. But that's not the only taproot. This Eisenhower concept is not the only taproot of the nuclear sharing policy. There are these two other taproots. First, the basic strategy for the defense of Western Europe adopted by the NATO Council in December of 1954. I'm sure none of you have heard of this before you took this class, but this is an extremely important event in the history of the Cold War. This strategy was called MC, for Military Committee, MC-48, December of 1954. Right? This is a strategy for the defense of Western Europe, not a deterrence strategy, pure and simple. It's not a tripwire strategy. For the first time in the history of NATO, Western Europe is going to be defended on the ground. And how are you going to do this? According to MC-48, there was one and only one way in which Europe could be defended, and that was through the massive, concentrated, and extremely rapid use of nuclear weapons, both tactically and strategically, both in the theater and against the Soviet homeland. Right? The high watermark of the emphasis on nuclear weapons in NATO strategy. Never so great up to that point, never so great after that point. What was the basic idea here? It's like in the event of war, you're going to defend Europe by destroying the sources of military power in the Soviet homeland. Dry up the sources of military power through a massive, very rapid, and you know, huge, you know, huge in extent, but concentrated in time. You wanted this thing to go fast, so that the ability of the Soviet economy to generate military power that it could use in the war would be wiped out. But you still, even if you're able to attack these forces in the Soviet homeland in such a way that they wouldn't be able to launch an attack against your own homeland in the United States, you still had to worry about what was going on in the actual theater of combat in Central Europe, right? Because the Soviets had a lot in terms of forces and being. So you had to be able to hold the line in Central Europe during this relatively brief period when their forces there were just kind of withering on the vine because they couldn't be resupplied by new materials generated by the Soviet war economy, which you would have destroyed. Right? And so you would do that, by relying on nuclear weapons in the theater. Right? You would have a NATO force, not just an American force, but a force of all these NATO allies, trained to operate in a nuclear environment, trained to use nuclear weapons. Right? And they could hold the line in that way against the Soviet force in Europe during this relatively brief period when that force is still a threat before it loses its power because it can't be resupplied because you've destroyed the sources of its power in the Soviet Union. Yes.
So first the plan was to nuke all of the Soviet Union, and then after that, there would still be forces in Eastern Europe that would attack Western Europe. They wouldn't have any supplies.
Well, yes. Eventually, they would run out of supplies. Maybe, I don't know, 1 or 2 week period. But during that period, you wanted to keep them away. So you wanted to kind of hit their nuclear stockpiles, their troop concentrations. You wanted to prevent them from being able to concentrate their troops in the first place. And your own forces, they're trained to operate in this nuclear environment.
But you attack the Soviet forces in Europe just with
No, with nuclear weapons, with the small nuclear weapons, tactical nuclear weapons. So they wouldn't cause that much damage to the surrounding areas. And you would attack them in such a way that it wouldn't cause very much fallout and so on. It's we have huge numbers of these things now because of the buildup that began in 1950, and we have the means of delivering them. A very heavy reliance on nuclear. Okay, that's the strategy. What are the implications of the strategy? Important to distinguish between what the strategy was and what the implications were. Three big implications: preemption, predelegation. I said nuclear strategy, I mean nuclear sharing. I made a mistake there. What does preemption mean? It means we go first. We hit them first. We hit them first and we hit them hard. Even before the war begins, you know, even before they attack us or commit, you know, a hostile act, as soon as we come to the conclusion that war is unavoidable, we launch this strike. It's quite extraordinary, isn't it? We start the war. All right, not that we're aggressors, but the only way we could pursue the strategy, the only way the strategy is be viable, is if we prevent the other side from being able to use its nuclear weapons against us, meaning both against the United States and against Western Europe. And the only way to do that is by destroying their nuclear forces before they get into the air, while they're still on the ground, right? And that means we have to move very fast, preemptively, before the war even starts. Very, very, and this is all clear to these people. You know, they're uneasy with it, right? Not only that, but who's going to make this decision to start the war? It's going to be pre-delegated. To whom? To the commander on the scene, the NATO commander, SACUR. SACUR is going to have a huge amount of power in this area. He'll be able to decide when the war would be started, because he would tell for his intelligence sources what the Soviets would seem to be getting ready to do. And nuclear sharing, the third great implication of MC-48. This is a world in which the only weapons worth having are nuclear weapons. Conventional forces are worthless, essentially. You know, if all you have are conventional forces, the Americans say, you're just going to be playing with marbles. If you want your forces to have real political significance, they have to be armed with nuclear weapons. Not only that, but all this emphasis on moving fast places an enormous premium on operational readiness. The forces you have, they got to be ready to use their nuclear weapons fast. You can't, you know, mess around with all these controls and safety controls and, you know, keeping these weapons under lock and key. They have to be deployed to the forces in the field, right? And the forces in the field have to be able to use them. So nuclear sharing, for those two reasons, is implicit in the MC-48 strategy. Right. All right, time here. Let's begin the lecture next time with the third great taproot of the nuclear sharing policy, namely the sense of in the inevitability of a Soviet second strike capability, and then I'll talk about how this stuff worked in practice and what effect it had on the larger political system.